Back in March, when all eyes were on Trump rallies and the media were questioning who exactly the Trump supporters were, we spoke to Nancy Eisenberg, author of the then upcoming book White Trash: The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Her book is now published and in bookstores, so we thought we'd give you the chance to hear that great discussion again, I say with all due humility. Anyway, at that moment in the campaign, the media were casting about for answers about the identities of Trump supporters.
We saw a Confederate battle flag poster at another Trump rally. There have been reports of other Confederate battle flag posters at Trump rallies.
According to this new poll, close to 20% of voters who support Donald Trump don't support the Emancipation Proclamation. They think Abraham Lincoln's decision to free enslaved Africans during the Civil War was the wrong thing to do.
So, are they a mob of ignorant racists? No.
One of the things fueling Trump's support is a feeling by a lot of white working class Americans that things have changed too fast. They don't recognize this country anymore.
So, they're the disaffected working class, squeezed out of the economy by globalism and increasingly marginalized by an influx of non-white immigrants. Well, no.
Almost everyone we've talked to who switched over, who crossed over, they said Trump, Trump, Trump. They want to change. They're tired of politics as usual, Brian.
All right, Tony, something tells me you're on top of a big story there.
So, they're an astute political cohort that has run out of patience with a political class tainted by money, biased toward privilege, and welded to the status quo. Or all of the above. Or none of the above. In a piece he wrote for the National Review in March, writer Kevin Williamson called Poor White America the scene of, quote, dysfunction and negligence and incomprehensible malice. Also, quote, the truth about these dysfunctional downscale communities is that they deserve to die, unquote. And he refers to, quote, family anarchy, which is to say the whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog. Brutal assumptions, but to Nancy Eisenberg, not shocking.
That is a really, really old insult. The poor were often compared to curs or a mongrel dog, and these were seen as an inferior breed. You know, they usually would compare the cur to the hound. So a hound is a legitimate dog that works. A cur isn't.
Eisenberg told us that the contempt for the poor found in the National Review can be traced back to the foundation of America, when the British, who called the poor waste people, saw the New World not as a land of religious liberty, but as an ideal dumping ground.
For the British, there were four ways you could deal with the poor. You hoped that maybe they would die from starvation or disease. The other way was that maybe they would commit a crime and they would be thrown into prison. The other option was that you would drum them into service. They would be sent off to fight. Soldiers were also referred to as waste. And then the final way was that they would be sent to the colonies, outposts that needed people, places like Jamestown. But whether they survived or not was a secondary concern.
But there was a revolution, and the Founding Fathers aimed to do away with hierarchy and aristocracy and replace it with liberty and justice for all. In your book, you look at this through the lens of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, who we see as progressive types, generally. But Franklin was not at all sympathetic to the plight of the poor when he developed the Pennsylvania Hospital in 1751. The perpetually impoverished weren't welcome there.
Yeah, and this was also a very classic pattern that existed in Great Britain. You would distinguish the poor who can be helped, those who can be put back into the workforce, and then others who he again sort of assumed were expendable, that there's no need to waste money or effort trying to rehabilitate them.
And Jefferson held two different views in his mind at the same time. He had noble ideas of simple people, hard-working yeoman farmers, but he also referred to the poor as rubbish.
Right. The reason he called them rubbish, he's saying it in the context of calling for how some selected young men from poorer families should be given some kind of state-supported education. They would be raked from the rubbish. That phrase already assumes that even if you rake a few, there's still going to be a pile of rubbish left.
And then you have the westward expansion in the 19th century and some new slang, notably squatter and cracker.
squatter referred to them squatting down, sitting on land that they didn't own. And that is the exact opposite of the British notion of standing. And standing is the legal principle that defines one's territorial right to the land. So they're squatters because they're thieves. Jefferson referred to them as trespassers on the public lands. And the word cracker, this comes from the English idea of cracking a jest, cracking wind. Also, there was the term louse cracker. A louse cracker was a lice-ridden, slovenly, nasty fellow, and that's true by 1720. But it also takes us back to our favorite concept of idleness, because another important connection is that it was drawn from the idea of crack-brained, which denoted not only a crazy person, but it was the English slang for a fool or an idle head.
Even if squatters weren't particularly respected or trusted, they had to be pandered to every few years in order to get people elected. And you mentioned the story of the Arkansas Traveler from 1840.
Yeah, the Arkansas Traveler tells the story of a rich politician canvassing in the backcountry, and he asks a squatter for some refreshment. The squatter is seated on a whiskey barrel, and he ignores him. And the politician is obliged, in order to get his refreshment, in order to get his vote, to, you know, jump off his horse, grab the squatter's fiddle, and show that he can play his kind of music. And that, I think, really is a recurrent problem with our American democracy. What we really have is a democracy of manners, not a real democracy. And what I mean by that is that we accept huge disparities in wealth, but we demand that our politicians look like us, or sound like us, or dress like us.
Eat our corn dogs.
Right. And it's all a performance. This is actually one of the things that I see Trump doing. The key to his appeal is the way he talks. You know, he's blunt, he's offensive, and his supporters view that as raw honesty. Even though he comes from a pampered life of wealth and privilege, every time he opens his mouth, he affirms his allegiance to the working poor. That's what they like about him.
You know, at this point, we should address the fact that yours is explicitly a history of the white lower class. You don't suggest that there wasn't fierce and violent racism in both the lower and the upper classes, or that the treatment of poor whites, however horrible, was anywhere near as bad as those who were enslaved or racially discriminated against.
Race is a very important category of my book. I talk about how prominent Southern politicians, particularly at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, are seen as inciting poor white racism, supporting lynching. There are numerous moments when race and class become intertwined. But one of the things that I think most people would find really surprising is that the Southern planter elite, before the Civil War, valued their slaves more than they valued white trash, because slaves were at least productive.
And actually, the phrase white trash emerges around the time of the Civil War, right?
Yeah, well, it really assumes prominence in politics in the 1850s, because it's part of the language that is adopted by the Republican Party when they critique the South and the slave economy. This is when they begin to see the poor white trash as this dangerous offshoot. They see their children as old before their time, shriveled. They are described as a curious species. And they ask this question, are these really Americans? How could America have produced such people? Because they are seen as physically deformed, uneducated, and dangerous. And this is how they are turned into a group that by the eugenics period, it's not enough to just assume that we can dump them somewhere. Now you have to make sure that they can't reproduce.
There is one point in our history, you note, when there was active intervention to actually improve the lives of the poor. You had FDR's New Deal, though it was largely aimed at the white population.
Suddenly, 20% of the population is out of work. You can't just blame one group for being an inferior breed, or you can't just blame them for somehow being lazy and idle, because now a large portion of the population find themselves shorn of their ability to be productive members of society. Suddenly people are willing to listen and think about the poor and look at them in a very different way. And this is the one of the things that, you know, James Agee captured so beautifully when he argued that to understand the poor, we have to understand that we, the middle of the elite class, who've looked down upon them and shamed them, have contributed to the problems that they face.
In the years of civil rights legislation, school desegregation, your book goes into detail about how the rest of the U.S. thought of poor whites who were protesting such progress as bigots, as inbred, and so on. Many of them back in the 60s were racist, and certainly some Trump supporters are today, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a conundrum. They do subscribe to certain views that are undoubtedly racist, and you can't mask it and pretend that it's not there. It is very much a part of their thinking. But the other problem is when people want to blame poor whites for being the only racist in the room, and that happens as well, as if they're more racist than everyone else. Again, it reinforces the whole cycle again, that they don't deserve to be a part of civil society because their ideas are so backward.
Whereas many people have said, basically Trump has put down the dog whistle and said things in plain English that have been said for years and years in politer language. And this brings us back around. Does the media's treatment of these people and the assumptions the media make reflect what you've seen play out over the last 400 years when discussing the white working class?
But the problem is our media is just too dismissive and everything's reduced to a soundbite. When you refer to people as just being angry, it's another insult. When Jefferson used it, he was referring to someone who's primitive and is so angry they can't speak. And it's that same idea that they're not advanced enough to understand their interests, and therefore all they can do is show emotion and be angry. We have to begin to pay attention to class, because people are shocked when invisible people begin to speak. They say, where did this come from? How can this happen in America? How can this explain the way we imagine the myth of social mobility? So all we tend to get from the media is usually shock. And then it recedes into the background again and no one talks about it.
What do we gain by directly addressing class issues? And what do we lose by denying them?
We have to talk about class because it essentially defines people in the most fundamental ways. You are born into a class station. You get privileges from your family. You inherit privileges from where you live. It is the essence of who we are. The most troubling thing people don't want to accept is that there are large numbers of Americans who do not experience social mobility. And it's not just because they're inept or they're lazy or they're stupid. It has to do with the town that they live in, the opportunities that they have, the education that they're offered, all those things that we pretend to value. I mean, we only had a real middle class in this country because of all the New Deal legislation, because of the loans given to housing, because of the growth of the economy. So it requires us to admit that we are in some way responsible for the existence of poverty. And that's what we don't want to admit.
Nancy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Nancy Eisenberg is the T. Harry Williams Professor at Louisiana State University and author of White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America, in bookstores now. You've been listening to an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Brooke Gladstone.